observed absently that he seemed so much more at ease when he wasn't with her. Her surprise at his not being at work, after all, was slowly replaced by a kind of wistfulness, a remembrance of the man she had fallen in love with. As she watched, wondering whether to walk over and confide in him about her disastrous evening, a girl standing just to his left turned and held up a bottle of cola. It was Peggy Foreman. She leaned in close and said something that made him laugh, and he nodded, his eyes still on Tex Lafayette. Then he looked back at her, and his face creased into a goofy smile. She wanted to run up to him then, to push that girl out of the way, to take her place in the arms of her husband, have him smile tenderly at her as he had before they were married. But even as she stood, people were backing away from her, laughing or muttering, "Skunk." She felt her eyes brim with tears and, head down, began to push her way back through the crowd.
"Hey!"
Alice's jaw jutted as she wound her way through the jostling bodies, ignoring the jeers and laughter that seemed to swell in bursts around her, the music fading into the distance. She was grateful that the dark meant barely anybody could see who it was as she wiped the tears away.
"Good Lord, did you catch that smell?"
"Hey, Alice!"
Her head spun round, and she saw Fred Geisler pushing his way through the crowd toward her, his arm outstretched.
"You okay?"
It took him a couple of seconds to register the smell. She saw a shock flicker across his features, a silent "whoa," and then, almost immediately, his determined attempt to hide it. He placed an arm around her shoulders, resolutely steering her through the crowd.
"Come on, let's get you back to the library. Move over there, would you? Coming through."
It took them 10 minutes to walk back up the dark road. As soon as they were out of the center of town, away from the crowds, Alice stepped out of the shelter of his arm and took herself to the side of the road.
"You're very kind, but you really don't need to."
"It's fine. Got almost no sense of smell anyway. First horse I ever broke caught me in the nose with a back foot, and I've never been the same since."
She knew he was lying, but it was kind, and she shot him a rueful smile.
"I couldn't see for sure, but I think it was a skunk. It just stopped in front of me and..."
"Oh, it was a skunk, all right."
He was trying not to laugh. Alice stared at him, her cheeks flaming. She thought she might actually burst into tears, but something in his expression felled her, and to her surprise, she began to laugh instead.
"Worst thing ever, huh?"
"Truthfully, not even close."
"Well, now I'm intrigued. So what was the worst?"
"I can't tell you."
"Two skunks?"
"You have to stop laughing at me, Mr. Geisler."
"I don't mean to hurt your feelings, Mrs. Van Cleve. It's just so unlikely. A girl like you, so pretty and refined and all, and that smell."
"You're not really helping."
"I'm sorry. Look, come to my house before you go to the library. I can find you some fresh clothes so you can at least get home without causing a commotion."
They walked in silence the last 100 yards, peeling off the main road up the track to Fred Geisler's house, which, being behind the library and set back from the road, Alice realized she had barely registered until now. There was a light on in the porch, and she followed him up the wooden steps, glancing left to where, 100 yards away, the library light was still on, only visible from this side of the road through a tiny crack in the door. She pictured Sophia in there, hard at work stitching new books out of old, humming along to the music, and then he opened the door and stood back to let her in. Men who lived alone around Baileyville, as far as she could make out, lived rough lives, their cabins functional and sparsely furnished, their habits basic, and hygiene often questionable. Fred's house had sanded wood floors, waxed and burnished through years of use. A rocker sat in a corner, a blue rag rug in front of it, and a large brass lamp cast a soft glow over a shelf of books. Pictures lined the wall, and an upholstered chair stood opposite, with a view out over the rear of the building and Fred's large barn full of horses. The gramophone was on a highly polished mahogany table, and an intricate old quilt lay neatly folded to its side.
"But this is beautiful," she said,
realizing as she did the insult in her words. He didn't seem to catch it.
"Not all my work," he said, "but I try to keep it nice. Hold on."
She felt bad bringing this stench into his sweet-smelling, comfortable home. She crossed her arms and winced as he jogged upstairs, as if that could contain the odor. He was back in minutes, with two dresses across his arm.
"One of these should fit."
She looked up at him.
"You have dresses?"
"They were my wife's."
She blinked.
"Hand me your clothes out and I'll douse them in vinegar. That'll help. When you take them home, get Annie to put some baking soda into the wash tub with the soap. Oh, and there's a clean washcloth on the stand."
She turned, and he gestured toward a bathroom, which she entered. She stripped down, pushed her clothes out through a gap in the door, then washed her face and hands, scrubbing at her skin with the washcloth and lye soap. The acrid smell refused to dissipate. In the confines of the warm little room, it almost made her gag, and she scrubbed as hard as she could without actually removing a layer of skin. As an afterthought, she poured a jug of water over her head, rubbing at her hair with soap and rinsing it, then rough-drying it with a towel. Finally, she slipped into the green dress. It was what her mother would have called a tea dress, short-sleeved and floral, with a white lace collar, a little loose around the waist, but at least it smelled clean. There was a bottle of scent on top of a cabinet. She sniffed it, then sprayed a little on her wet hair. She emerged some minutes later to find Fred standing by the window, looking down at the illuminated town square. He turned, his mind clearly lost elsewhere, and perhaps because of his wife's dress, he seemed suddenly shaken. He recovered himself swiftly and handed her a glass of iced tea.
"Thought you might need this."
"Thank you, Mr. Geisler."
She took a sip.
"I feel rather silly."
"Fred, please, and don't feel bad, not for a minute. We've all been caught."
She stood for a moment, feeling suddenly awkward. She was in a strange man's home, wearing his dead wife's dress. She didn't know what to do with her limbs. A roar went up somewhere in town, and she winced.
"Oh, goodness. I haven't just made your lovely house smell awful, but you've missed Tex Lafayette. I'm so sorry."
He shook his head.
"It's nothing. I couldn't leave you looking so..."
"Skunks, eh?"
she said brightly, and his concerned expression didn't shift, as if he knew that the smell was not the thing that had so upset her.
"Still, you can probably catch the rest of it if we head back now," she said.
She had started to gabble.
"I mean, it looks like he'll be singing a while. You were quite right. He's very good. Not that I heard a huge amount, what with one thing and another, but I can see why he's so popular. The crowd does seem to love him."
"Alice."
"Goodness, look at the time. I'd better head back."
She walked past him toward the door, her head down.
"You should absolutely head back to the show. I'll walk home. It's no distance."
"I'll drive you."
"In case of more skunks?"
Her laugh was high and brittle. Her voice didn't even sound like her own.
"Honestly, Mr. Geisler, Fred, you've been so very kind already, and I don't want to put you to more trouble. Really, I don't..."
"I'll take you," he said firmly.
He took his jacket from the back of a chair, then removed a small blanket from another and placed it around her shoulders.
"It's turned chilly out there."
They stepped onto the porch. Alice was suddenly acutely aware of Frederick Geisler, of the way he had of observing her, as if looking through whatever she said or did to assess its true purpose. It was oddly discomforting. She half stumbled down the porch steps, and he reached out a hand to steady her. She clutched at it, then immediately let go as if she'd been stung.
"Please don't say anything else," she said silently.
Her cheeks were aflame again, her thoughts a jumble. But when she glanced up, he wasn't looking at her.
Was that door like that when we came in?
He was staring at the back of the library. The door, which had been open a sliver to allow in the sound of the music, was now wide open. A series of distant, irregular thumps came from within. He stood very still, then turned to Alice, his ease of the previous minutes gone.
Stay there.
He strode swiftly back inside, and then, a moment later, emerged from his house with a large double-barreled rifle. Alice stepped back as he passed, watching as he walked toward the library. Then, unable to stop herself, she followed a few paces behind, her feet silent on the grass, as she tiptoed down the back path.
What seems to be the problem here, boys?
Frederick Geisler stood in the doorway. Behind him, Alice, her heart in her mouth, could just make out the scattered books on the floor, an overturned chair. There were three young men in the library, dressed in jeans and shirts. One held a beer bottle, and another an armful of books, which, as Fred stood there, he dropped with a kind of provocative deliberation. She could just make out Sophia standing, rigid, in the corner, her gaze fixed on some indeterminate point on the floor.
You got a colored in your library.
The boy's voice held a nasal whine and was slurred with drink.
Yep, and I'm standing here trying to work out what business that is of yours.
This is for white folks. She shouldn't be here. Yeah.
The other two young men, emboldened by beer, jeered back at him.
Do you run this library now?
Fred's voice was icy. It held a tone she had never heard before.
I said, do you run this library, Chet Mitchell?
The boy's eyes slid sideways, as if the sound of his own name had reminded him of the potential for consequences.
No.
Then I suggest you leave, all three of you, before this gun slips in my hand and I do something I regret.
You threatening me over a colored?
I'm telling you what happens when a man finds three drunk fools on his property. And if you like, just as easy, I'll tell you what happens if a man finds they don't leave as soon as he tells them. Pretty sure you ain't going to like it, though.
I don't see why you're sticking up for her. You got a thing for Brownie here?
Quick as a flash, Fred had the boy by the throat, pinned against the wall with a white-knuckled fist. Alice ducked backward, her breath in her throat.
Don't push me, Mitchell.
The boy swallowed, raised his palms.
It was just a joke, he choked. Can't take a joke now, Mr. Geisler.
I don't see anyone else laughing. Now get.
Fred dropped the boy, whose knees buckled. He rubbed at his throat, shot a nervous look at his friends, and then, when Fred took a step forward, ducked out through the back door. Alice, her heart pounding, stepped back as the three stumbled out, adjusting their clothes with a mute bravado, then walked in silence back down the grit path. Their courage returned when they were out of easy range.
You got a thing for Brownie, Frederick Geisler? That why your wife left?
You can't shoot for shit anyway. I seen you hunting.
Alice thought she might be sick. She leaned on the back wall of the library, a fine sweat prickling on her back, her heart rate only easing when she could just make them out disappearing around the corner. She could hear Fred inside, picking up books and placing them on the table.
I'm so sorry, Miss Sophia. I should have come back sooner.
Not at all. It's my own fault for leaving the door open.
Alice made her way slowly up the steps. Sophia, on the surface, looked unperturbed. She stooped, picking up books and checking them for damage, dusting their surfaces and tutting at the torn labels. But when Fred turned away to adjust a shelf that had been shoved from its moorings, she saw Sophia's hand reach out to the desk for support, her knuckles tightening momentarily on its edge. Alice stepped in and, without a word, began tidying too. The scrapbooks that Sophia had so carefully been putting together had been ripped to pieces in front of her. The carefully mended books were newly torn and hurled across the room, loose pages still fluttering around the interior.
"I'll stay late this week and help you fix them," Alice said.
And then, when Sophia didn't respond, she added,
"That is, if you're coming back."
"You think a bunch of snot-nosed kids are going to keep me from my job? I'll be fine, Miss Alice."
She paused and gave her a tight smile.
"But your help would be appreciated, thank you. We have ground to make up." "I'll speak to the Mitchells," said Fred. "I'm not going to let this happen again."
His voice softened, and his body was easy as he moved around the little cabin. But Alice saw how every few minutes his focus would shift to the window, and that he only relaxed once he had the two women in his truck, ready to drive them home. Chapter 8. Before today, Jody had been a boy, dressed in overalls and a blue shirt, quieter than most, even suspected of being a little cowardly. And now he was different. Out of a thousand centuries, they drew the ancient admiration that a man on a horse is spiritually as well as physically bigger than a man on foot. They knew that Jody had been miraculously lifted out of equality with them and had been placed over them. John Steinbeck, The Red Pony. Given the speed at which news traveled through Baileyville, its snippets of gossip starting as a trickle, then pushing through its inhabitants in an unstoppable torrent, the stories of Sophia Kenworth's employment at the Pack Horse Library and its trashing by three local men were swiftly deemed serious enough to warrant a town meeting. Alice stood shoulder to shoulder with Marjorie, Beth, and Izzy in a corner at the back, while Mrs. Brady addressed the assembled gathering. Bennett sat two rows back beside his father.
"You going to sit down, girl?"
Mr. Van Cleve had said, looking her up and down as he entered.
"I'm fine right here, thank you," she had answered, and watched as his expression turned disapprovingly toward his son.
"We have always prided ourselves on being a pleasant, orderly town," Mrs. Brady was saying. "We do not want to become the kind of place where thuggish behavior becomes the norm. I have spoken to the parents of the young men concerned and made it clear that this will not be tolerated. A library is a sacred place of learning. It should not be considered fair game just because it is staffed by women."
"I'd like to add to that, Mrs. Brady."
Fred stepped forward. Alice recalled the way he had looked at her on the night of Tex Lafayette's show, the strange intimacy of his bathroom, and felt her skin prickle with color, as if she had done something to be ashamed of. She had told Annie the green dress belonged to Beth. Annie's left eyebrow had lifted halfway to the heavens.
"That library is in my old shed," said Fred. "That means, in case anyone here is in any doubt, that it is on my property. I cannot be responsible for what happens to trespassers."
He looked slowly around the hall.
"Anyone who thinks they have business heading into that building without my permission, or that of any of these ladies, will have me to answer to."
He caught Alice's eye as he stood down, and she felt her cheeks color again.
"I understand you have strong feelings about your property, Fred," Henry Porteous stood. "But there are larger issues to discuss here. I, and a good number of our neighbors, am concerned about the impact this library is having on our little town. There are reports of wives no longer keeping house because they are too busy reading fancy magazines or cheap romances. There are children picking up disruptive ideas from comic books. We're struggling to control what influences are coming into our homes."
"They're just books, Henry Porteous. How do you think the great scholars of old learned?"
Mrs. Brady's arms folded across her chest, forming a solid, unbridgeable shelf.
I'd put a dollar to a dime the great scholars were not reading The Amorous Sheik of Araby, or whatever it was my daughter was wasting her time with the other day. Do we really want their minds polluted with this stuff? I don't want my daughter thinking she can run off with some Egyptian.
Your daughter has about as much chance of having her head turned by a sheik of Araby as I do of becoming Cleopatra.
But you can't be sure.
You want me to go through every book in this library to check for things that you might find fanciful, Henry Porteous? There are more challenging stories in the Bible than there are in the Pictorial Review, and you know it.
Well, now you sound as sacrilegious as they do.
Mrs. Bydecker stood.
May I speak? I would like to thank the book ladies. Our pupils have very much enjoyed the new books and learning materials, and the textbooks have proven very useful in helping them progress. I go through all the comic books before we hand them out, just to check what is inside, and I have found absolutely nothing to concern even the most sensitive of minds.
But you're foreign!
Mr. Porteous interjected.
Mrs. Bydecker came to our school with the highest of credentials, Mrs. Brady exclaimed. And you know it, Henry Porteous. Why, doesn't your own niece attend her classes?
Well, maybe she shouldn't.
Settle down, settle down.
Pastor McIntosh climbed to his feet.
Now, I understand feelings are running high, and yes, Mrs. Brady, there are some of us who do have reservations about the impact of this library on formative minds, but what? There is clearly another issue here, the employment of a colored. What issue would that be, Pastor? You may favor the progressive ways, Mrs. Brady, but many in this town do not believe that colored folk should be in our libraries.
That's right, said Mr. Van Cleve.
He stood and surveyed the sea of white faces.
The 1933 Public Accommodations Law authorizes, and I quote here, the establishment of segregated libraries for different races. The colored girl should not be in our library. You believe you're above the law now, Marjorie O'Hare?
Alice's heart had lodged somewhere in her throat, but Marjorie, stepping forward, appeared supremely untroubled.
Nope.
Nope?
No, because Miss Sophia isn't using the library. She's just working there.
She smiled at him sweetly. We've told her very firmly she is under no circumstances to open any of our books and read them. There was a low ripple of laughter. Mr. Van Cleve's face darkened.
You can't employ a colored in a white library. It's against the law and the laws of nature.
You don't believe in employing them, huh?
It's not about me, it's about the law.
I'm most surprised to hear you complaining, Mr. Van Cleve, she said.
What do you mean by that?
Well, given the number of colored folk you got over there at your mine.
There was an intake of breath.
I do not.
I know most of them by person, as do half the good people here. You listing them as mulatto on your books doesn't change the facts.
Oh, boy.
Said Fred under his breath.
She went there.
Marjorie leaned back against the table.
Times are changing, and colored folk are being employed in all sorts of ways. Now, Miss Sophia is fully trained and is keeping published material in commission that wouldn't otherwise be able to stay on the shelves. Those Baileyville bonus magazines, you all enjoy them, right? With the recipes and the stories and all?
There was a low murmur of agreement.
Well, those are all Miss Sophia's work. She takes books and magazines that have been spoiled, and she stitches what she can save back together to create new books for y'all.
Marjorie leaned forward to flick something from her jacket.
Now, I can't stitch like that, and neither can my girls, and as you know, volunteers have been hard to come by. Miss Sophia isn't riding out, visiting families, or even choosing the books. She's just keeping house for us, so to speak. So until it's one rule for everyone, Mr. Van Cleve, you and your mines and me and my library, I will keep on employing her. I trust that's acceptable to y'all.
With a nod, Marjorie walked out through the center of the room, her gait unhurried and her head held high. The screen door slammed behind them with a resounding crash. Alice had said nothing the whole journey back from the meeting hall, walking away behind the two men, from where she could hear the kind of muttered expletives that suggested an imminent and volcanic explosion. She didn't have long to wait.
Who the Sam hell does that woman think she is, trying to embarrass me in front of the whole town?
I don't think anyone felt you were...
Bennett began, but his father threw his hat on the table, cutting him off.
She's been nothing but trouble her whole life, and that criminal daddy of hers before her, and now standing there trying to make me look like a fool in front of my own people?
Alice hovered in the doorway, wondering if she could sidle upstairs without anybody noticing. In her experience, Mr. Van Cleve's tantrums rarely burned out quickly. He would fuel them with bourbon and continue shouting and declaiming until he passed out late in the evening.
"Nobody cares what that woman says, Pop,"
Bennett began again.
"Those coloreds are listed as mulatto at my mine because they're light-skinned. Light-skinned, I tell you!"
Alice pondered Sophia's dark skin and wondered, if she was sister to a miner, how siblings could be completely different colors, but she said nothing.
"I think I'll head upstairs," she said quietly.
"You can't stay there, Alice."
"Oh, God," she thought, "don't make me sit on the porch with you."
"Then I'll come..."
"At that library. You ain't working there no more. Not with that girl."
"What?"
She felt his words close around her like a stranglehold.
"You'll hand in your notice. I'm not having my family aligned with Marjorie O'Hare's. I don't care what Patricia Brady thinks. She's lost her mind along with the rest of them."
Van Cleve walked to the drinks cabinet and poured himself a large glass of bourbon.
"And how the heck did that girl see who was on the mine's books anyway? I wouldn't put it past her to be sneaking in. I'm going to put a ban on her coming anywhere near Hoffman."
There was a silence, and then Alice heard her voice.
"No."
Van Cleve looked up.
"What?"
"No, I'm not leaving the library. I'm not married to you, and you don't tell me what I do."
"You'll do what I say. You live under my roof, young lady."
She didn't blink. Mr. Van Cleve glared at her, then turned to Bennett and waved a hand.
"Bennett, sort your woman out."
"I'm not leaving the library."
Mr. Van Cleve turned puce.
"Do you need a slap, girl?"
The air in the room seemed to disappear. She looked at her husband. "Don't you think of laying a hand on me," she told him silently. Mr. Van Cleve's face was taut, his breath shallow in his chest. "Don't you even think about it." Her mind raced, wondering suddenly what she would do if he actually lifted his hand to her. Should she hit back? Was there something she could use to protect herself? What would Marjorie do? She took in the knife on the breadboard, the poker by the range. But Bennett looked down at his feet and swallowed.
"She should stay at the library, Pa."
"What?"
"She likes it there. She's doing a good job, helping people and all."
Van Cleve stared at his son. His eyes bulged out of his beet-red face as if someone had squeezed him from the neck.
"Have you lost your damned mind as well?"
He stared at them both, his cheeks blown out and his knuckles white, as if braced for an explosion that wouldn't come. Finally, he threw the last of the bourbon down his throat, slammed down his glass, and set off outside, the screen door bouncing on its hinges in his wake. Bennett and Alice stood in the silent kitchen, listening to Mr. Van Cleve's Ford sedan starting up and roaring into the distance.
"Thank you,"
she said. He let out a long breath and turned away. She wondered then whether something might shift, whether the act of standing up to his father might alter whatever had gone so wrong between them. She thought of Kathleen Bly and her husband, the way that, even as Alice read to him, Kathleen would stroke his head as she passed or place her hand on his, the way, sick and frail as he was, Garrett would reach out for her, his hollowed face always finding even the faintest smile for his wife. She took a step toward Bennett, wondering if she might take his hand, but, as if reading her mind, he thrust both into his pockets.
"Well, I appreciate it," she said quietly, stepping back again.
And then, when he didn't speak, she fixed him a drink and went upstairs. Garrett Bly died 2 days later, after weeks of hovering in a strange, rasping hinterland, while those who loved him tried to work out whether his lungs or his heart would give out first. The word went round the mountain. The bell tolled 34 times so that everyone nearby could tell who had departed. After they had finished their day's work, the neighboring men gathered at the Bly household, carrying good clothes in case Kathleen had none, ready to lay out, wash, and dress the body, as was the local custom. Others began to build the coffin that would be lined with cotton and silk. Word reached the Packhorse Library a day later. Marjorie and Alice, by tacit agreement, shared out their routes between Beth and Izzy as best they could, then set out for the house together. There was a sharp wind that, instead of being blocked by the mountains, simply used them as a funnel, and Alice rode the whole way with her chin pressed into her collar, wondering what she could say when she reached the little house, and wishing she had an appropriate greetings card, or perhaps a posy to offer. In England, a house in mourning was a place of silence, a vaguely whispered conversation, shaded by a cloak of sadness or awkwardness, depending on how well the deceased was known or loved. Alice, who often managed to say the wrong thing, found such hushed occasions oppressive, a trap that she would no doubt fall into. When they reached the top of Hellmouth Ridge, though, there was little suggestion of silence. They passed cars and buggies dotted lower down the track, abandoned on the verge as the passing became impossible, and when they reached the house, strange horses' heads poked out of the barn, whickering at each other, and muffled singing came from inside. Alice looked over to a small bank of pine trees, where three men were digging in heavy coats, their picks sending clanging sounds into the air as they hit rock, their faces puce, and their breath pale gray clouds.
"Is she going to bury him here?" she said to Marjorie.
"Yep, his whole family's up there."
Alice could just make out a succession of stone slabs, some large, some heartbreakingly small, telling of a Bly family history on the mountain stretching back generations. Inside, the little cabin was full to bursting. Garrett Bly's bed had been shoved to one side and covered with a quilt for people to sit on. Barely an inch of space remained that wasn't covered with small children, trays of food, or singing matriarchs who nodded at Alice and Marjorie as they entered without breaking off their song. The windows, which Alice remembered had contained no glass, were shuttered, and carbide lamps and candles lit the gloom so that it was hard to tell inside if it was day or night. One of the Bly children sat on the lap of a woman with a prominent chin and kind eyes, and the others nestled into Kathleen as she closed her eyes and sang too, the only one of the group to be somewhere far from there. A trestle table had been set up, on which lay a pine coffin, and Alice could just make out within it the body of Garrett Bly, his face relaxed in death, so much so that, for a moment, she wondered whether it was him at all. His hollowed cheekbones had somehow softened, his brow now smooth under soft, dark hair. Only his face was visible, the rest of him covered with an intricate patchwork quilt and strewn with flowers and herbs that scented the air. She had never seen a dead body, But somehow, here, surrounded by the songs and warmth of the people around him, it was hard to feel shock or discomfort at its proximity.
"I'm so sorry for your loss," Alice said. It was the only phrase she had been coached to say, and here it seemed sterile and useless. Kathleen opened her eyes and, taking a moment to register, smiled vaguely at Alice. Her eyes were rimmed pink and shadowed with exhaustion.
"He was a fine man and a fine father," said Marjorie, sweeping in and holding her tightly.
Alice wasn't sure she'd ever seen Marjorie hug someone before.
"He'd had enough,"
Kathleen murmured, and the child in her arms looked at her blankly, her thumb thrust deep into her mouth.
"I couldn't wish him to stay any longer. He's with the Lord now."
The slack of her jaw and her sad eyes failed to mirror the conviction of her words.
"Did you know Garrett?"
An older woman with two crocheted shawls around her shoulders tapped the 4 inches of bed space beside her so that Alice felt obliged to squeeze her way in too.
"Oh, a little. I'm just the librarian."
The woman peered at her, frowning.
"I only knew him from my visits."
It came out apologetically, as if she knew she shouldn't really be there.
"You're the lady used to read to him?"
"Yes."
"Oh, child, that was such a comfort to my son."
The woman reached out and pulled Alice to her. Alice stiffened, then gave in to her.
"Kathleen told me many times how much Garrett looked forward to your visits, how they would take him quite out of himself."
"Your son? Oh my goodness, I'm so sorry."
She meant it.
"He really did seem the nicest of men, and he and Kathleen were so very fond of each other."
"I'm much obliged to you, Miss..."
"Mrs. Van Cleve."
"My Garrett was a fine young man. Oh, you didn't see him before. He had the broadest shoulders this side of the Cumberland Gap, didn't he, Kathleen? When Kathleen married him, there were 100 crying girls between here and Berea."
The young widow smiled at the memory.
"I used to tell him I had no idea how he could even make his way into that mine with a build like his. Of course, now, I wish he hadn't. Still..."
The older woman swallowed and lifted her chin.
"Not for us to question God's plan. He's with his own father, and he's with God the Father. We just have to get used to being down here without him, don't we, sweetheart?"
She reached out and squeezed her daughter-in-law's hand.
"Amen," someone called.
Alice had assumed that they would pay their respects and leave, but as morning became afternoon, and afternoon swiftly fell to dusk, the little cabin grew fuller, with miners arriving after their shift, their wives bringing pies and souse and fruit jellies, and as time slid and stalled in the dim light, more people piled in, and nobody left. Chicken appeared in front of Alice, then soft biscuits and gravy, fried potatoes, and more chicken. Somebody shared some bourbon, and there were outbreaks of laughter, tears, and singing, and the air in the tiny cabin grew warm, thick with the scents of roasted meats and sweet liquor. Someone produced a fiddle and played Scottish tunes that made Alice feel vaguely homesick. Marjorie occasionally shot her a look, as if checking she was okay, but Alice, surrounded by people who would clap her on the back and thank her for her service, as if she were a military man, not just an Englishwoman delivering books, was oddly glad just to sit and absorb it all. So Alice Van Cleve gave herself to the strange rhythms of the evening. She sat a few feet from a dead man, ate the food, sipped a little of the drink, sang along to hymns she barely knew, clasped the hands of strangers who no longer felt like strangers. And when night fell and Marjorie whispered in her ear that they really should get going now because a hard frost would be setting in, Alice was surprised to find that she felt as if she was leaving home, not heading back to it. And this thought was so disconcerting that it pushed away all else for the whole of the slow, cold, lantern-lit ride, back down the mountain. Chapter 9. Many medical men now recognize that numerous nervous and other diseases are associated with the lack of physiological relief for natural or stimulated sex feelings in women. Dr. Marie Stopes, Married Love. According to the local midwives, there was a reason most babies came in summer, and that was because there wasn't a whole heap to do in Baileyville once the light had gone. The picture house tended to get its movies some months after they had been and gone elsewhere. Even when they came, Mr. Rand, who ran it, loved his liquor, to the extent that you could never be sure that you'd see the end of the show before a reel crumpled and burned on screen, victim to one of his impromptu naps, prompting jeers and disappointment across the audience. Harvest Festival and hog slaughter had slid past, and it was too early for Thanksgiving, which left a long month with nothing but darkening skies, the increasing smell of wood smoke in the air, and the encroaching cold to look forward to. And yet, it was apparent to anybody who took notice of such things, and Baileyville's residents made whole careers out of taking notice, that this fall an inordinate number of local men seemed oddly cheerful. They raced home as soon as they could and whistled their way through their days bug-eyed with sleep deprivation, but shorn of their usual short tempers. Jim Forrester, who drove for the Matthews Lumberyard, was barely seen at the honky-tonks, where he usually spent his non-working hours. Sam Torrance and his wife had taken to walking around holding hands and smiling at each other. And Michael Murphy, whose mouth had been welded into a thin line of dissatisfaction for most of his 30-odd years, had been seen singing, actually singing, to his wife on his porch. These were not developments that the elders of the town felt able to complain about exactly, but certainly added, they confided to each other with a vague feeling of discombobulation, to a sense that things were shifting in a way they were at a loss to understand. The inhabitants of the Packhorse Library were not quite as perplexed. The little blue book, which had proven more popular and more useful than any number of bestsellers and required almost constant repair, was dispatched and returned week after week under piles of magazines with quick, grateful smiles accompanied by whispered murmurings of, "My Joshua never even heard of such a thing, but he sure does seem to like it," and, "No baby this springtime for us. I cannot tell you the relief." A honeymooner's blush would accompany many of these confidences, or a distinct twinkle in the eye. Only one woman returned it stony-faced, with the admonition that she had never seen the devil's work cast into print before. But even then, Sophia noted that there were several pages where the corners had been carefully turned to keep their place. Marjorie would slide the little book back into its home in the wooden chest where they kept cleaning materials, blister liniment, and spare stirrup leathers, and a day or two later, the word would be passed to another remote cabin, and the query would be made, tentatively, to another librarian.
Before you go, my cousin over at Chalk Hollow says you have a book that covers matters of a certain delicacy.
And it would find itself on its way again.
What are you girls doing?
Izzy and Beth sprang back from the corner as Marjorie walked in, kicking mud from the heels of her boots in a way that would infuriate Sophia later. Beth was quite helpless with laughter, and Izzy's cheeks glowed pink. Alice was at the desk, entering her books into the ledger and pretending to ignore them.
Are you girls looking at what I think you're looking at?
Beth held up the book.
Is this true, that female animals may actually die if denied sexual union?
Beth was open-mouthed.
Because I'm not hanging off no man, and I don't look like I'm fit to drop, do I?
But what do you die of? Said Izzy, aghast.
Maybe your hole closes up, and then you can't breathe properly, like one of them dolphins.
Beth!
Exclaimed Izzy.
If that's where you're breathing out of, Beth Pinker, then lack of sexual congress isn't the thing we need to be worrying about, said Marjorie.
Anyway, you girls shouldn't be reading about that.
You're not even married.
Nor are you, and you've read it twice.
Marjorie pulled a face. The girl had a point.
Jeez, what are the natural completions of a woman's sex functions?
Beth started to giggle again.
Oh my, look here. This says that women who don't get satisfaction may suffer an actual nervous breakdown. Can you believe that? But if they do get satisfaction, every organ in their bodies is influenced and stimulated to play its part, while their spirits, after soaring in the dizzy heights of rapture, are wafted to oblivion.
My organs are meant to be wafting? Said Izzy.
Beth Pinker, will you shut up for 5 minutes?
Alice slammed her book down on the desk.
Some of us are actually trying to work here.
There was a brief silence. The women exchanged sideways looks.
I'm just joking with you.
Well, some of us don't want to hear your horrible jokes. Can you just cut it out? It's not funny.
Beth frowned at Alice. She picked casually at a piece of cotton on her breeches.
I'm so sorry, Miss Alice. I hate that I might have caused you distress, she said solemnly.
A sly smile spread across her face.
You're not having a nervous breakdown, are you?
Marjorie, who had lightning-quick reaction times, managed to get between them just before Alice's fist made contact. She raised her palms, pushing them apart, and gestured Beth toward the door.
Beth, why don't you check those horses have fresh water? Izzy, put that book back in the trunk and come and sweep up this mess. Miss Sophia gets back from her aunt's tomorrow, and you know what she'll have to say about it all.
She looked at Alice, who had sat down again, and was now staring with intense concentration at the ledger, her whole demeanor warning Marjorie not to say another thing. She would be there long after the rest of them had gone home, as she was every working night. And Marjorie knew she wasn't reading a word. Alice waited until Marjorie and the others had left, raising her head to mutter goodbye. She knew they would talk about her when they were gone, but she didn't care. Bennett wouldn't miss her. He would be out with friends. Mr. Van Cleve would be late at the mine, as he was most nights, and Annie would be tutting about 3 dinners gone dry and shriveled in the bottom of the range. Despite the companionship of the other women, she felt so lonely she could weep with the weight of it. She spent most of her time alone in the mountains, and some days she talked more to her horse than any other living being. Where once it had offered her a welcome sense of freedom, now the vast expanses seemed only to emphasize her sense of isolation. She would turn up her collar against the cold, wedge her fingers into her gloves, with miles of flinted track in front of her, and only the ache in her muscles to distract her. Sometimes she felt as if her face was set in stone, apart from when she finally stopped to deliver her books. When Jim Horner's girls ran to her for hugs, it was all she could do not to hold tight to them and let out an involuntary, silent sob. She had never thought of herself as someone who needed physical contact, but night after night, yards away from Bennett's sleeping body, she felt herself slowly turning to marble.
Still here, huh?
She jumped. Fred Geisler had put his head around the door.
Just came to bring a new coffee pot. Marge said the old one had sprung a leak.
Alice wiped at her eyes and gave him a bright smile.
Oh, yes. Go right ahead.
He hesitated on the threshold.
Am I disturbing something?
Not at all.
Her voice was forced, too cheery.
I won't be a minute.
He walked over to the side, replacing the metal coffee pot and checking the tin for supplies. He kept the women in coffee every week without so much as mentioning it, and brought in logs to keep the fire burning so that they could get warm between rounds.
Frederick Geisler, Beth would announce every morning, smacking her lips at her first cup, is a veritable saint.
Brought you all some apples, too. Thought you could take a couple each to work. You'll be getting hungrier now the days are colder.
He pulled a bag from inside his overcoat and put them on the side. He was still wearing his work clothes, his boots hemmed by a layer of mud around the sole. Sometimes she would hear him outside as she arrived, talking to his young horses with a yip and a come on now, smarty pants, you can do better than that. As if they were just as much his friends as the women in the cabin, or standing, arms crossed, beside some fancy horse owner from Lexington, sucking his teeth as they discussed conformation and price.
These here are Rome beauties. They ripen a little later than the rest.
He shoved his hands into his pockets.
I always like to have something to look forward to.
That's very kind of you.
It's nothing. You girls work hard and don't always get the credit you deserve.
She thought he would leave then, but he hesitated in front of the desk, chewing the side of his lip. She lowered her book and waited.
Alice, are you all right?
He spoke the words as if this was a question he had already rolled over in his head 20, 30 times.
It's just, well, I hope you don't mind me mentioning, but you seem so much less happy than you did. I mean, when you first came.
She felt her cheeks color. She wanted to say, I'm fine, but her mouth had dried and nothing would come. He studied her face for a moment, and then he walked slowly across to the shelves to the left of the front door. He scanned them, a nod of satisfaction escaping him when he found what he was looking for. He pulled a book from the shelf and brought it to her.
She's a bit of a misfit, but I like the fire in her words. When I felt low, a few years back, I found some of these were helpful.
He took a scrap of paper, marking the page he had sought, and handed it to her.
I mean, you may not like them. Poetry is kind of a personal thing. I just thought...
He kicked at a loose nail on the floor. Then, finally, he looked up at her.
Anyways, I'll leave you to it.
Then, as if compelled, he added,
Mrs. Van Cleef.
She didn't know what to say. He walked to the door, raising a hand in awkward salute. His clothes were scented with wood smoke.
Mr. Geisler, Fred?
Yes?
She stood paralyzed, consumed with the sudden need to confide in another human being, to tell him of the nights that she felt something was being hollowed out at the very core of her, that nothing that had happened to her in her life up to now had left her feeling so leaden of heart, so lost, as if she had made a mistake that there was simply no coming back from. She wanted to tell him she feared the days she didn't work like she feared a fever, because outside the hills and the horses and the books, she often felt she had nothing at all.
Thank you,
she swallowed.
For the apples, I mean.
His response came a half second too late.
My pleasure.
The door closed quietly behind him, and she heard his footsteps heading up the path toward his house. He stopped halfway up, and she found herself sitting very still, waiting for what, she wasn't even sure, and then the footsteps continued, fading into nothing. She looked down at the little book of poetry and opened it. The Giver of Stars by Amy Lowell. Hold your soul open for my welcoming. Let the quiet of your spirit bathe me with its clear and rippled coolness, that loose-limbed and weary I find rest, outstretched upon your peace as on a bed of ivory. She stared at the words, her heart thumping in her ears, her skin prickling as they shaped and reformed themselves in her imagination. She thought suddenly of Beth's astonished voice. Is it true that some female animals will die if denied sexual union? Alice sat for a long time, gazing at the page in front of her. She wasn't sure how long she stayed like that. She thought about Garrett Bly, his hand reaching blindly for his wife's, the way their eyes locked in mutual understanding, even in his final days. Finally, she stood up and walked to the wooden trunk. Glancing behind her, as if even then someone might see what she was doing, she rummaged through it until she pulled out the little blue book. She sat down at the desk and, opening it, began to read. It was almost 9:45 p.m. by the time she returned home. The Ford was outside, and Mr. Van Cleve was in his room, pulling open his drawers and ramming them shut with so much force that she could hear him from the hall. She closed the front door behind her and walked quietly upstairs, her mind humming, her fingers trailing lightly on the banister. She reached the bathroom, closed and bolted the door, allowed her clothes to fall around her ankles, and used a washcloth to wipe away the day's grime so that her skin was once again soft and sweet-smelling. Then she walked back into her room and reached into her trunk for her silk nightdress. The peach-colored fabric collapsed, soft and fluid, across her skin. Bennett wasn't on the daybed. She saw only the broad back of him on their bed, lying, as he so often did, on his left side away from her. He had lost his summer tan, and his skin was pale in the half-light, the outline of his muscles moving gently as he shifted. Bennett, she thought. Bennett, who had once kissed the inside of her wrist and told her she was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen, who had promised a world in whispers, who had told her he adored every last bit of her. She lifted the coverlet and climbed into the warm space inside, barely making a sound. Bennett didn't stir, but his long, easy breaths told her he was deeply asleep. Let the flickering flame of your soul play all about me, that into my limbs may come the keenness of fire. She moved close, so close that she could feel her breath on his warm skin. She inhaled the scent of him, the soap mixed with something primal that even his military attempts at cleanliness couldn't erase. She reached out, hesitated just a moment, and then placed her arm over his body, finding his fingers and entwining them with her own. She waited and felt his hand close around hers, and she let her cheek rest against his back, closing her eyes the better to absorb the rise and fall of his breath. "Bennett," she whispered. "I'm sorry." Even as she was not entirely sure what she was sorry for. He released her hand, and for a second, her heart stilled, but he shifted his weight, turning so that he was facing her, his eyes just visible and open. He gazed down at her, her eyes great sad pools, begging him to love her. And perhaps in that moment, there was something in her expression that no sane man could refuse, because with a sigh, he placed an arm around her and allowed her to nestle into his chest. She placed her fingers lightly on his collarbone, her breath a little shallow now, her thoughts jumbling with desire and relief.
"I want to make you happy,"
she murmured, so quietly that she wasn't even sure he would hear her.
"Really, I do."
She looked up. His eyes searched hers, and then he lowered his mouth to hers and kissed her. Alice closed her eyes and let him, feeling the deep easing of something that had been wound so tightly that she had felt she could barely breathe. He kissed her and stroked her hair with his broad palm, and she wanted to just stay in that moment forever, where it was like they used to be. Bennett and Alice, a love story at its beginning. The life and joy of tongues of flame, and going out from you, tightly strung and in tune, I may rouse the blear-eyed world and pour into it. She felt desire build in her swiftly, its fuse lit by the poetry and the unfamiliar words of the little blue book, which conjured images that her imagination yearned to make flesh. She yielded her lips to his, let her breath quicken, felt a bolt of electricity when he let out a low groan of pleasure. His weight was on her now, his muscular legs between hers. She moved against him, her thoughts now lost, her whole body sparking with new nerve endings. Now, she thought, and even that thought was misted with urgent pleasure. Now, at last, yes.
"What are you doing?"
It took her a moment to work out what he was saying.
"What are you doing?"
She pulled her hand back, looked down.
I was just touching you.
There?
I thought you'd like it.
He pulled back, dragging the cover over his groin, leaving her exposed. Some part of her was still flushed with need, and it made her bold. She lowered her voice and placed her hand on his cheek.
I read a book this evening, Bennett. It's about what love can be between a man and his wife. It's by a medical doctor, and it says that we should feel free to give each other pleasure in all sorts of...
You're reading what?
Bennett pushed himself upright.
What is wrong with you?
Bennett, it was about married people. It was designed to help couples to bring each other joy in the bedroom and... Well, men apparently do love to be touched.
Stop! Why can't you just be a lady?
What do you mean?
It's touching and this reading of smut.
What in hell is wrong with you, Alice?
You make it impossible.
Alice sprang back.
I make it impossible? Bennett, nothing has happened in almost a year. Nothing. And in our vows, we promise to love each other with our bodies, as in all ways. Those were vows we made before God. This book says it's perfectly normal for a husband and wife to touch each other wherever they like. We're married. That's what it says.
Shut up.
She felt her eyes brim with tears.
Why are you being like this when all I am trying to do is make you happy? I just want you to love me. I'm your wife.
Stop talking. Why do you have to talk like a prostitute?
How do you know how a prostitute talks?
Just shut up.
He hurled the lamp from the bedside table so that it shattered on the floor.
Shut up! Do you hear me, Alice? Will you ever just stop talking?
Alice sat frozen. From next door, they heard the sound of Mr. Van Cleve groaning his way out of bed, the spring shrieking a protest, and she dropped her face into her hands, braced for what would inevitably come next. Sure enough, a few short seconds later, there was a loud rapping at their bedroom door.
What's going on in there, Bennett? Bennett, what's all the noise? Did you break something? Go away, Pa, okay? Just leave me alone!
Alice stared at her husband in shock. She waited for the sound of the fuse of Mr. Van Cleve's temper being lit again, but... Perhaps equally surprised by his son's uncharacteristic response, there was only silence. Mr. Van Cleve stood on the other side of the door for a moment, coughed twice, and then they heard him shuffle back to his room. This time, it was Alice who rose. She climbed off the bed, picking up the pieces of the lamp so that she didn't tread on them in bare feet, and placed them carefully on the bedside table. Then, without looking at her husband, she straightened her nightdress, pulled on her bed jacket, and made her way next door into the dressing room. Her face once again returned to stone as she lay down on the daybed. She pulled a blanket over herself and waited for morning or for the silence from the next room to stop weighing like a dead thing on her chest, whichever would come first, or would deign to come at all. Chapter 10. One of the most notorious feuds of the Kentucky Mountains began, in Hindman, as a result of the killing of Linvin Higgins. Dolph Drawn, a deputy sheriff of Knott County, organized a posse and started for Letcher County with warrants for the arrest of William Wright and two other men accused of the murder. In the fight that followed, several men were wounded and the sheriff's horse was killed. Devil John Wright, leader of the Wright faction, later paid for the animal because he regretted the killing of a fine horse. This feud lasted several years and was responsible for the death of more than 150 men. WPA, the WPA Guide to Kentucky. Winter had come hard to the mountain, and Marjorie wrapped herself around Sven's torso in the dark, hooking her leg around him for extra warmth, knowing that outside there would be 4 inches of ice to hack out of the top of the well and a whole bunch of animals waiting bad-temperedly to be fed, and that these two facts, every morning, made the last 5 minutes under the huge pile of blankets all the sweeter.
Is this your way of trying to persuade me to make the coffee?
Sven murmured sleepily, lowering his lips to her forehead and shifting just so she could be assured of quite how sweet he found it, too.
"Just saying good morning," she said, and let out a long, contented breath.
His skin smelled so good. Sometimes when he wasn't there, she would sleep wrapped in his shirt just to feel him near her. She trailed her fingers speculatively across his chest, a question he answered silently. The minutes crept by pleasurably until he spoke again.
"What's the time, March?"
A 4:45.
He groaned.
"You do realize that if you'd stay with me, we could get up a whole half hour later?
And it would be just as hard to do it. Plus, Van Cleve would no more let me near his mine these days than he would ask me to take tea at his house."
Sven had to admit she had a point. The last time she had come to see him, bringing a lunch pail he had forgotten, Bob at the Hoffman Gate had informed her regretfully that he had specific orders not to let her in. Van Cleve had no proof, of course, that Marjorie O'Hare had anything to do with the legal letters about blocking the strip mining of Northridge, but there were few enough people who had either the resources or the courage to have been behind it. And her public crack about the colored miners had plainly stung.
"So I guess it'll be Christmas here, then," he said.
"All the relatives as usual.
A packed house,"
she said, her lips an inch from his.
"Me, you, Bluey over there."
"Down, Blue."
The dog, taking his name as a sign that food was imminent, had hurled himself onto the bed and across the coverlet, his bony legs scrabbling on top of their entwined bodies, licking their faces.
"Ow, jeez, dog. Oh, that's done it. Okay, I'll make the coffee."
She sat up and pushed him away. She rubbed sleep from her eyes and detached regretfully the hand that had slid around her stomach.
"You saving me from myself, Bluey boy?"
Sven said, and the dog rolled over between them, tongue lolling, for his belly to be tickled.
"Both of you, huh?"
She grinned as she heard him fussing over the dog, the damn fool, and kept grinning the whole way into the kitchen, where she stooped, shivering, to light the range.
"So, tell me something,"
Sven said as they ate their eggs, their boots entwined under the table.
"We spend nearly every night together. We eat together. We sleep together. I know how you like your eggs, the strength of your coffee, the fact that you don't like cream. I know how hot you run your bath, the way you brush your hair 40 strokes, tie it back, and then don't look at it a lick for the rest of the day. Hell, I know the names of all your animals, even that hen with the blunt beak, Minnie."
"Winnie."
"Okay, nearly all your animals. So what is the difference between us living like this and doing it but just with a ring on your finger?"
Marjorie took a swig of her coffee.
"You said we weren't going to do this anymore."
She tried to smile, but there was a warning underneath it.
"I'm not asking, I promise. I'm just curious, because it seems to me there's not a whole heap of difference."
Marjorie put her knife and fork together on her plate.
"Well, there is a difference, because right now I can do what I like, and there's not much anyone could do about it."
"I told you that wouldn't change. I'd hope you know after 10 years that I'm a man of my word."
"I do. But it's not just freedom to act without having to ask permission. It's freedom in my head. The knowledge that I'm answerable to nobody, to go where I want, do what I want, say what I want. I love you, Sven, but I love you as a free woman."
She leaned over and took his hand.
"You don't think knowing that I'm here purely because I want to be, not because some ring says I have to be, is a greater kind of love?"
"I understand your reasoning."
"Then what?"
"I think..."
He pushed his plate away.
"I guess I'm just afraid."
"Of what?"
He sighed, turned her hand over in his.
"That one day you'll tell me